government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory
activity. $1.8 trillion.
That's how much business and
bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Episode 12 of the Free Lunch Podcast for the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. We've had a brief hiatus from creating podcasts, but glad to be back. We've not, however, paused from producing other great content, so please visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to view several papers and videos that we've posted recently, and to subscribe to our newsletter, and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast will explore two reports released by the Department of the Treasury on core principles for financial supervision. These reports, with more to come, are a part of President Donald Trump's larger regulatory reform agenda, and were generated in response to Executive Order 13772 signed by the President earlier this year. Today we'll explore several things. Among them are highlights from these reports and questions such as how or if these reports are at all setting the department's priorities, what difference might this all make with regard to financial regulatory reform, and what might we expect from the Federal Reserve, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and other financial regulators in response to these reports. So let's explore. I'm very pleased to have two guests as our Free Lunch Podcast speakers today. They are J.W. Verrett and Wayne Abernathy. Because we have much to discuss today and both of our speakers have extensive CVs, I won't diddle too long on introductions. I'll just say that J.W. is a professor at Scalia Law. He previously served as chief economist and senior counsel for the U.S. House Committee on Financial Services. And he's also a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center Working Group on Financial Markets, where he regularly briefs congressional staff, members of Congress, SEC commissioners, and other financial regulatory agencies on financial regulation topics. Wayne is the Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association. Immediately prior to joining the ABA, Wayne was Treasury Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions under Bush 43. Wayne has also held numerous posts with the Senate Banking Committee. After today's call, if you're interested in learning more about either of our featured speakers, you can find more information at regproject.org under our Financial Services and Corporate Governance Working Group page, the group within which both JW and Wayne serve as members. Okay, in just a moment, I'll turn the call over to JW. Before I do, I want to remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcast are those of our featured speakers. Additionally, Wayne and JW have agreed to take questions after their remarks, so prior to the start of the question and answer period, please be prepared with any questions that you might have about topics related to the Treasury reports or the President's regulatory reform efforts in the financial sector. Now, with that said, thank you, Wayne. Thank you, JW, for joining us today. JW, you have the floor.
Thanks so much, Devin, and thank you to the Federalist Society for this opportunity. I love these podcasts. I listen to them when I go jogging, and I'm pleased to join my friend Wayne Abernathy today and talk to him about the President's regulatory reform efforts as executed by the Treasury Department. I wanted to briefly go over the core principles for financial regulatory that were mentioned in the President's executive order in January. The President issued the executive order, and to fulfill it, the Treasury Department has started to release reports on financial regulatory reform. The first one came out in June and focused on reform in the banking sector. Three more are expected through the course of later this year, early next. I thought I'd read out the principles, core principles for financial regulation included in the President's executive order. First, to empower Americans to make independent financial decisions. to prevent taxpayer-funded bailouts, to foster economic growth, to enable American companies and banks to be competitive with foreign firms, and advance U.S. interests in international financial regulatory negotiations, to make regulation efficient, effective, and well-tailored, and to restore public accountability to federal financial regulatory agencies. So we're going to talk today, Wayne and I are going to have a little Q&A and a discussion to start off what I hope will be a fruitful Q&A with the listeners on today's call. I thought I would ask Wayne a few questions about some of the recommendations contained in the first report from the Treasury Department released in June of this year on bank regulatory reform. Wayne, just going through the page numbers near the end of this report, there are a series of recommendations. I'm looking on page 123. It's a recommendation that Congress address regulatory overlap. To what extent can the regulators do this themselves? Some of the president's nominees are coming on board. Vice Chairman Quarles of the Federal Reserve was recently installed as the Vice Chair for Supervision at the Fed. To what extent can the agencies address this themselves, and to what extent will this inherent regulatory rivalry sort of between the agencies limit their ability to coordinate?
Well, it's a good question, JW, and I'm very glad to be part of this telephone discussion today. It's really a pleasure to discuss the initiative of the president to ask all of the regulators to look at the whole body of regulations that have been put in place over the past not just few years, but many years, and ask what's working and what can be work better. And what I think that has done overall is place regulatory reform and refinement at the top of the priority list. Now, with regard to how the different regulatory agencies deal with that, and that's an important thing to keep in mind, the Treasury can make recommendations, but the Treasury doesn't regulate itself very much. It's in essence going to rely upon the regulators themselves to implement a lot of this. With regard to dealing with the overlap, the regulators can do some of that, and they have, frankly, done some of that over the years. But there's also a tension between the regulators, and frankly, that's not all bad. If you had to ask yourself the question, would I prefer that our federal government had dozens of regulators or just one regulator who does it all? I think the answer would be, I kind of like the idea that the power is split up amongst a bunch of different people who may have different views and different perspectives, and that kind of models the separation of power that we have in the federal government overall. So I would say the fact that we have a variety of different regulators in the financial area is not a bad thing, but you do want to have coherence in the regulatory policies that are put together. So to some degree, already the regulators do work together. There's one organization that I'll mention, for example, called the FFIEC. This is the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Organization, was put together to make sure that the examination of banks is done in a way that coordinates and best uses the resources. For example, it used to be, before the FFIEC was created, you were a typical banker. As soon as your bank regulator left, let's say you're a national bank, as soon as the OCC left the door, in came in the FDIC, because they're the ones that insured your deposits, and they examined the same thing that the previous regulator did. And then when the FDIC left, in came the Federal Reserve, because they supervise bank holding companies, and they did the same supervision all over again. And the regulators realized, you know, how's these guys going to do any business if we're examining them all the time, one after another after another? And they then came upon this idea of, let's coordinate what we're doing, and they developed the FFIEC to do that. So the regulators can coordinate, but you're right that there is a tension that can prevent them from to some degree. I think that is where the good role of the Treasury can come in, not just in setting these recommendations, but, and I'm speaking from experience of having served at the Treasury, because Treasury doesn't actually regulate in this sphere, the regulators look to Treasury and their good offices as a means of bringing folks together. And the Secretary of the Treasury, for example, back in under the Reagan administration, was given a responsibility to chair something that was called the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. The Secretary of the Treasury chaired that. Members of the working group were the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, the Chairman of the SEC, and the Chairman of the CFTC. They were looking at the functioning of markets. Treasury was given the responsibility to chair that because they, in a sense, didn't have a direct dog in the fight and could bring these folks together. And it worked pretty well. So I think much of what Treasury is suggesting can be done, but I think there's a natural tension that maybe helps to keep it from being overdone.
Wayne, you mentioned the FFIEC, this international, this interagency coordinating group for regulators and regulatory examinations. What do you think about some ideas floating around, at least on the House side in Congress, to create a sort of appellate body for bank examiners? If you run into issues with your bank examiner and multiple examinations, particularly if you're a bank holding company regulated by the Fed, but you also have a broker-dealer regulated and examined by the SEC. What about this idea for an appellate body composed of private sector people with experience in the industry? Is that workable, and does that have political salience?
I think the general concept of making sure that everybody's accountable to somebody is part of what makes our governmental system work. There should not be any part of the federal government, state governments either, where people are not accountable to someone. And yet, in fact, our current regulatory, at least the bank regulatory program in the United States, is a little bit deficient in that regard. Part of the deal that's been given to banks that in exchange for getting a charter, every bank has a charter from some governmental agency, along with that comes the fact that the bank is examined by bank examiners who have tremendous power and authority. The problem is that when a bank examiner exceeds his authority or exceeds his responsibilities or engages in really just really bad judgment, if you want to appeal those decisions, actions, interpretations of the examiner, with the exception of the National Bank Examiner, the Comptroller of the Currency, these agencies correct their own tests. If you think that a Federal Reserve examiner has gone out of bounds, where do you appeal that? To the Federal Reserve. And you rarely get the problem resolved. You rarely get satisfaction. The same is true of the FDIC. The OCC, the National Bank Examination Agency, they have an ombudsman who at least to some degree has authority actually to overturn a decision by an examiner and has a certain amount of independence. But the idea of having a body that's outside of any one of these agencies to look at the conduct of the examiners, I think that's part of the genius of our government and part of what's necessary to make sure that we have a government that is accountable, ultimately, to the people who are governed. And so that's not a bad idea.
Now, Wayne, speaking of accountability, regulatory accountability, one of the things that the Treasury report recommends on page 125 is changes to the way the bank regulators conduct stress tests. The idea behind the stress tests, which the regulators had some power to do before Dodd-Frank, but got an extra sort of second level of power to do post-Dodd-Frank, was to come in and do something like a stress test on the human heart, really just sort of work up a model of what would happen if the worst possible things in the economy went wrong. In the worst scenario we've seen over the last 50 years, how would a particular bank hold up? It's this way of sort of getting under the hood and looking at what's going on. Unfortunately, what we've seen, I think one of the salient criticisms of the way the Federal Reserve has conducted stress tests has been that they've been fairly opaque. No one's really quite sure why they pass or why they fail. And it's not always clear who's going to pass or fail. Sometimes a lot of them pass. Sometimes a few fail that are unexpected. Some banks spend $100 million in a single year just to prepare for this one test. And when the Federal Reserve has been asked to just share more of the sort of the grading sheet of how they grade these things, the Federal Reserve has tended to respond that that would be a disaster because people would essentially build models to the test. What I should note too, Vice Chairman Quarles, the new vice chairman, has emphasized the importance of transparency in these stress tests during his confirmation hearing. So we have the Treasury recommendation, and we have Vice Chairman Quarles' new effort to bring transparency here. Do you think that's important? And more importantly, do you think it's possible? Or will the bureaucracy kind of resist that transparency and just put something through notice and comment that isn't going to be binding on them later?
Well, those are all excellent questions, and I think they're very important. Go to, again, our theory of our system of government. if we believe, which we do as a nation, that we're in a society where there's the rule of law that prevails, in order for the rule of law to prevail, you got to know what the laws are. And the way the stress tests are administered, they are administered as if these are specific requirements imposed upon a banking industry, but the bank doesn't know what the requirements are until they enter into the room and they go through the tests. And then they discover afterwards whether they met the test or not, based upon standards that they weren't aware were going to be applied to them. And I don't understand, frankly, the value in doing that when the purpose of the stress test is to see whether the bank is able to meet various economic or financial traumas that the bank might face as the economy goes through this or that kind of situation. Wouldn't it be better for the banks to know what it is they're supposed to do or what is expected of them so that they can prepare for that? It seems to me the purpose of a good regulation is to guide behavior. To guide the behavior, you have to know what you're supposed to do before you act rather than what you should have done after you've acted. And I think that could only improve our stress test system if those scenarios were looked at ahead of time. And in fact, I think they'd benefit if the regulators would put out for comment what they are planning to use as their scenarios for the upcoming stress test, and let people comment. Let the economists and other people in the economy provide their ideas and share their thoughts and critique the plan that the regulators have put forward. I think that would only improve the stress test scenario and make it much more likely to be reflective of what the real range of potential scenarios might be with some kind of realism. That just seems to me to make a whole lot of sense, as well as being consistent with our system of government. This idea of working to the test, I think that's what regulation's all about, letting us know what the tests are going to be.
Rather than gotcha sort of games.
Yeah, gotcha before, or you're trying to guess what it is you're supposed to do, and you talk about the cost of what's involved. A lot of that cost is banks trying to guess what's going to be required of them and guiding and adjusting their practices based upon assumptions that may or may not be correct, not assumptions based upon how best to provide goods and services to their customers, but rather assumptions as to what is going to be expected of them by the bureaucracy. I would much rather that people were guiding their banks and their policies based upon what they think the needs will be from their customers, given the potential range of likely scenarios in the foreseeable future, vetted in a very public process.
And Wayne, do you think that the recommendation in the Treasury report that others have voiced, I think some in a bipartisan way, to move the stress test to a two-year cycle will, in addition to the transparency efforts, will that two-year cycle rather than annual stress test be helpful? Would it meaningfully reduce costs while not compromising the regulatory objectives?
I think if you make that as the standard, that the standard stress tests are biennial, I don't think you lose anything. The argument might be, well, what if some kind of stress comes up that's unforeseeable or something arises that we weren't looking at, a significant drop in the energy markets or something like that? The regulators always retain the ability to look at any institution with regard to risks that they see that have come up unexpectedly or that they believe need to be part of the supervisory process. You wouldn't want to take that away from them. But with regard to the regular statutory stress tests, that's kind of a different exercise beyond the normal supervisory process. I don't see any reason why. It doesn't seem to me that you lose much, if anything, if you go to a two-year cycle. The regulators, frankly, have announced, the regulators, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, have announced with regard to the living wills, which is a related kind of process, that had been an annual exercise whereby banks would have to show to the regulators, if we get into trouble, this is how we would unwind our business. They just recently announced that they're looking at going to a biennial rather than an annual requirement for the living wills. I think that similarly makes sense with regard to the stress tests. A biennial approach, I think, would be worthwhile doing. And let's see how that goes and see if we actually lose anything. I don't think we will.
Wayne, since you mentioned living wills, this idea, you know, the two tools for our callers outside of the banking field, the two really powerful tools and very subjective discretionary tools created by Dodd-Frank and empowered by Dodd-Frank, given to the regulators, were these stress tests and these living wills. The stress test is sort of like an annual look at how healthy you are under stress. How would you survive as a bank in the event of the most stressful economic situation over the last 30, 40, 50 years? If it happened today, what would happen? And then the living wills process is a process whereby you sort of go through a tabletop exercise of unwinding yourself, and you submit a living will, a plan for how to unwind yourself to the regulators every year. And they judge that as well. Wayne, on the living will transparency and reform issues, one of the recommendations in Treasury's report is to take the FDIC out of the living will process and leave it to the Fed. Now, there have been some issues with having two regulators approving these living wills, and rather than it being two heads better than one, I think it's been more of a case of too many cooks boiling the broth here with living will review. So it's understandable to have some concern about that, but Treasury wants to take FDIC out of the living will process. FDIC does the liquidation. Is that the liquidation of banks themselves? Is that a problem, or is that something you generally would see industry supporting to limit the too many cooks problem?
Certainly, the experience that we've had with the living will process, and it was a brand new process, hadn't existed before Dodd-Frank. So it's been a learning exercise for banks and regulators, and it has been getting better with each year. But nevertheless, there is a tension, and sometimes a dysfunctional tension, between the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and the way they look at things. I think from the point of view of what Americans expect from their banks, they want the banks to be able to operate and provide the services that they're created to do. That is the approach that the Federal Reserve takes in looking at the living wills process. They're looking at this process from the point of view of, is the bank able to wind itself down in a way that it's able to continue to provide services while it's doing the unwinding as with regard to a failing institution? And moreover, does the living will process, the way it's being implemented and applied, act as a constraint on the ability of banks to meet the needs of their customers, or does it facilitate that ability? The FDIC looked at it from just one point of view, and that the point of view was, how quickly and easily can we put this bank out of its business? And maybe that's an approach to take once an institution has failed, but keep in mind that very few, if any, of the banks that submit living wills will ever actually have to execute on their living will. And keeping in mind the continued operation of an institution to provide the services that people rely on them to provide, that's the basic purpose of regulation, the basic purpose of the bank, and that has been the general approach and attitude of the Federal Reserve. And with regard to the large numbers of banks that we have, and that nearly all of them will continue to survive and succeed, some will grow, some will not grow as much, but what we want them to continue to provide their services, that should be the attitude and approach of our regulators. So I think going to just one of the two regulators, and probably the Federal Reserve, makes the most sense from the point of view of, why do we have banks anyway?
Well, let me switch topics a little bit to another topic mentioned on the recommendations of this report. Capital was mentioned on page 124 and then on 126. First to page 126. Just to give a little bit of backstory and discussion between, I guess, the industry perspective, the Republican perspective, and some libertarian think tank perspectives on some of these issues. In the way capital funding requirements were put together before Dodd-Frank and still post-Dodd-Frank, there's differential treatment for government securities when banks hold sovereign debt. Traditionally, pre-Dodd-Frank, it was treated as very low risk. Now, that's one perspective to have with respect to U.S. treasuries, but for some much more risky sovereign debt, that's not necessarily appropriate. You can imagine one of the conflicts there is that government regulators want to encourage banks to hold government debt. That's always been, and I think that's one theme explored in, say, for example, writings by Charlie Calamiris and others critical of government abuse of banks, trying to encourage banks to buy up government debt to fund, essentially fund, subsidize deficit spending by governments. So with that backdrop, I think it's accurate to say Republicans were very skeptical, particularly in the post-crisis world, of preferential treatment for sovereign debt. Now, fast forward to today, there are some discussions about various ways in which banks are regulated from a liquidity perspective, and the ways that municipal debt is treated for HQLR or SLR, two acronyms that float around this type of regulation. The way those things are treated, the way treasuries are treated with respect to SLR, the way municipal bonds are treated with respect to HQ, high-quality asset categories. Wayne, what's your perspective on this and whether it makes sense to, now that these regulations are in place and they seem fairly concrete, amend them to give some preferential treatment to things like munis and treasuries? What do you think about the continued sort of philosophical skepticism that we don't want government bank regulators to over encourage banks holding government obligations?
Well, it's more than philosophical. It is operational. If you look at the variety of regulations that have been put in place in the last several years, they're put in place by one government agency. And it shouldn't surprise folks if, in the effort to try to identify what they consider to be low-risk assets, that government agency favors other government instruments. Remember, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, other federal agencies, they're really all parts of the same entity. They're all parts of the federal government. Different divisions, different departments, but it's all the federal government. And whenever they have created, whether it's a capital rule, whether it's a liquidity rule, whether it's a stress test program, whether it's supervising bank activities, preferential treatment is given to the government securities, treasury securities, cash, deposits at the Federal Reserve. Now, having said that, those are very low risk, at least for the United States, very low risk assets, but they're not the only low risk assets. But having concentrated on those things, we're in a very difficult situation, and I think, frankly, a very risky situation when we head toward a recession. So let's say we're heading toward a recession at some point, and there will be at some point. So far as I can tell, nothing has repealed the laws of business and economics that have their cycles. So at some point, we will have a downturn in the economy. In many cases, you see those downturns coming on. Sometimes they're a surprise, but more often than not, you know when you're heading into them because of this, that, or the other that's built up as a problem in the economy. When that happens, banks are required under what's called the liquidity rules, the liquidity coverage ratio, to have a certain percentage of their assets, whatever their assets are, in what they call high-quality liquid assets, HQLA. A certain percentage of their assets have to be in those assets, and they're defined very narrowly under the regulations as treasury securities, reserves held at the Federal Reserve, cash on hand, and a very, very narrow amount of municipal securities and some AAA bonds. But it's very narrow. The problem is, as you head toward that downturn in the economy, banks knowing that they will have to have these and not knowing how much the regulators will require, because the regulators can change those requirements as time goes by, they will hoard those. They will not be willing to let go of those particular assets. At the same time, you have other regulations that demand those same assets. If you want to engage in the swaps business, you have to have collateral against your swaps exposures. Swaps are instruments that you use to manage your risk. I trade my risk that I don't want for your risk that you don't want, and you come up with a better management of risk. But for that, you have to be holding as collateral these very same instruments. In addition, the SEC said, We don't like the idea that some money market mutual funds are managed so that the cost of one share, the value of one share, is a dollar. The idea of marking it to a dollar and a stable net asset value. And so the SEC passed a rule saying the only money market mutual funds that are allowed to maintain a value of their shares at $1 are ones that invest in, guess what? Those very same assets, treasuries,
yeah,
cash reserves at the Fed. So you head into a downturn of the economy, everybody's wanting the same stuff and you can't get it, and the risk is you then freeze up the economy, not because the economy is not rich in liquidity, and we are far richer in liquidity than just those assets, but because the definition is so narrow. That needs to be opened up to recognize the wealth of liquidity, even in an economic downturn, that there is in our economy.
Wayne, since we're speaking of capital and liquidity regulation, I want to ask you about page 124 of the recommendations. It includes an off-ramp recommendation that's similar to that found in Chairman Hensarling's Financial Choice Act, the idea being that one way to do that would be a pretty strict increase in capital funding requirements, defined as a leverage ratio that's higher than that of the leverage ratio funding, that funding measure that large financial institutions typically hold at present. And once you meet that, you get an off-ramp to get a series of helpful deregulatory options. Do larger firms in the industry sort of actively oppose this idea, or are they merely disinterested? As Chairman Hensarling mentioned, and I think as you know, his Democratic opponents tended to obfuscate in the debate, big banks didn't support that aspect of his Financial Choice Act. But my question is sort of, are they just disinterested in taking that option, given the increase in leverage ratio they would have to do to get it, or are they merely disinterested? And then generally speaking, is it more healthy to encourage more sort of heterogeneity in bank regulation with competing charter types and competing regulatory approaches, so they can all operate a little differently, and so they won't all fail at the same time, the way the sort of Basel-oriented approach led to in 2008?
Well, those are interesting questions, and it's interesting the way they interact with one another. So let me try to deal with them together. With regard to the interest in that proposal from the larger banks, disinterested is really how I describe it. They don't really care about it. They don't think they're ever going to want to hold that much leverage capital, because in their view, which I think is correct, leverage capital is risk blind. It doesn't pay any attention to the risks of the assets you're holding. It treats every asset. It treats a long-term investment in a gold mine the same as it would treat a long-term investment in a AAA corporation or in a mortgage or any other type of asset. They're all treated the same, totally risk blind. And that's not the way a large bank wants to run their business. But the interesting thing is we don't find much interest in that proposal from banks of any size. There are a lot of other provisions in the Choice Act that they're very fond of because they think that there's much in there that will bring greater rationality to the regulatory system, relieve a lot of unnecessary burden, and liberate banks to be more effective in meeting the needs of their customers. But that idea of that off-ramp, it's hard to find much interest in that from very many banks of any size. And I think part of that is their worry that even though in the Choice Act it's presented as an option, that if you want to have this much leverage capital and then have a pass from certain types of regulations, then that would be fine. What the banks fear, and I think justifiably based upon experience over long term, is what starts out as an option over time ends up becoming mandatory. And so that optional, even higher super level of leverage capital becomes a requirement on the banks. And that, in essence, shrinks the ability of banks to meet the needs of their customers. So that's the big worry that they have. And the result of that is, and this is that other point that you make, does that counter the idea that we currently have in our banking system of having a wide variety of different types of banks? A few years ago, for a meeting at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, I put together a list, at least I started one, of the different types of banks that we have in the United States, different types of bank business models, structures, charters, and so forth. I quit at 28, but there are certainly more. But
wow,
that wide variety of different banks matches the wide variety of bank customers, and I think we want to encourage that. But if you have one measure that governs all of your regulation, as this could become, you then tend to homogenize your banks. And I don't think we want to do that.
I've got another question to ask, and I'll ask, and we'll talk a little bit, Wayne, while we wait for our audience to queue up to ask questions. So I just want to remind our audience now to go ahead and Devin, is there a process they need to take to queue up for a question?
Yeah, I'll just open the floor now, JW, and allow okay. Anyone who's interested to go ahead and ring in. If you'd like to ask a question after I open the floor mode, listeners, all you need to do is enter star and then the pound button. Let me open the floor now. Okay, the floor mode is on. So if you'd like to ask a question, all you need to do is hit the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keypad. We'll allow people to begin thinking about that, JW. You can proceed.
Okay, so looking at page 126 in the recommendations, there's a suggestion for a more cautious approach to participation in international financial regulatory forums. One of the critiques when I was working on the House for Chairman Hinshelwing, we often raised to Secretary Liu and to Governor Tarullo was, it seems as though the regulators go to the international forums, like the Financial Stability Board, they get a deal done there for some regulatory change, and then they come back and they say, I'm sorry, we're sort of locked in because our international forum has locked us into a commitment on an international level. And so we even for things that might have gone through notice and comment, they didn't take a serious approach to notice and comment because the regulation was largely baked in already through the international forum, at which the U.S. threw its weight around and got intended to get its way. How can we ensure the next administration, even if this administration is dedicated to limiting abuse of those international forums, how can it make sure the administration that follows will continue to be dedicated to that? As a sort of a general question, Wayne, and I love two-part questions. The second part is there's a recommendation to reform international holding company regulations of holding companies of foreign banks operating in the United States. The last administration was pretty aggressive. The next one could streamline those regs. Post-Brexit, is there an opportunity for the U.S. Fed and the Bank of England to get together to work on some kind of a bilateral regulatory reform effort with respect to, for us, IHCs, and in England for U.S. banks operating there? Is there a post-Brexit opportunity? So how do we reform international financial regulatory participation generally? And do we have some post-Brexit opportunities to work a regulatory streamlining deal with Britain?
Well, that's important to consider because the United States is blessed with being a generally open society, and so a lot of businesses want to come and do business in the United States, and that includes foreign banks. And we have benefited from the financial resources that foreign banks have brought to the United States by coming and doing business here with the U.S. We like the fact that our banks are able to do business abroad in Europe and in Asia and elsewhere. That diversifies those banks and makes them stronger as well. And it makes the international economy work a lot better. It makes us all richer. So all of that is good. The problem is, and it's really one that only got into high gear with the last administration, and you pointed to some of those problems. I often refer to it as regulatory laundering, where you would have our regulators that would go abroad to an international forum to propose or get involved with a new rule to impose on the financial system that they wouldn't be able to impose here on the United States on their own. So they go abroad, they negotiate it, and they bring it back saying, well, we got to do this because it's part of the international deal. The problem is not only that you impose then on the United States things that you couldn't have done on your own, but you're doing it through a body that has very little accountability. And our system of government only works when you have adequate accountability in place. There is very little, almost no accountability for what's negotiated in Basel. The regulators will come back and say, well, yes, of course, that's not a treaty. Those are just discussions where they put together standards. But nevertheless, we feel bound by them, and so we're going to implement the regulations here. And they're very loath to deviate from those global standards, even when they don't fit the U.S. economy very well. And I'll give one example of that I think really illustrates it very, very well. We talked a little bit about the liquidity coverage ratio, this global standard with regard to the amount of liquidity and the form of liquidity that banks have to follow and the liquidity events they have to prepare for. Under that LCR, one of the requirements is that U.S. banks, going into a stress situation, economic downturn, whatever that might be, the banks have to assume that they will lose deposits when that happens. And maybe that's what happened in Europe. Maybe that's what happened in Asia. In the United States, the exact opposite happens. During the most recent economic downturn, which everybody likes to talk about as being the worst since the Depression, or however you want to characterize it, you know what happened to deposits at U.S. banks? Increased by nearly $1 trillion. U.S. banks gained deposits during economic downturn because people are looking for safe places to put their money, and they see banks as those safe places, the banking industry as that safe place to put their money. Yet, under this global rule, banks have to pretend that they're going to lose deposits, and that affects actually the ability of the banks to take in deposits during a global downturn. So when our next recession comes, you could find banks in very difficult, U.S. banks, in a very difficult situation of having to say to a lot of their customers, we normally would like to take your deposits, the rules won't let us do it. The costs of us taking in your deposits would be prohibitive. I'm sorry, go find somewhere else to put your money. Banks don't want to be in that position. A global rule is pushing them into that position, and that's because there was not enough accountability when that rule was put in place. How do you deal with it? Well, certainly one of the things that I think could help, and it's a suggestion that we have, and it's if this practice were put in place, it would help regardless of whether you had one administration or another in place. And it's relying upon a structure that regulators, not just bank regulators, but other regulators have relied upon in the United States for a long time. It's a thing called an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. When an agency wants to propose a rule, they put it out for comment, and they draft the language. They say, this is the rule we're thinking of doing. Tell us what you think about it. You've got 60, 90, 120 days to comment on it. But sometimes when an agency is not quite sure where they want to go, before they actually draw up a rule for proposal, they will put out for comment ideas of where they're thinking of going with something. They're still trying to get more input to try to get an idea of what might make sense. That's called an advance notice of public rulemaking or proposed rulemaking. What we would recommend is that before our agencies go and start a negotiation abroad or engage in one abroad, first they publish an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, an ANPR, in which they say, this is the problem we're thinking about addressing. These are the various ways that people have talked about addressing it. Here is our analysis of how these different approaches might affect the economy. Tell us what you think before we go and start the discussions. That tips everybody off that something is going on and gets not only the public but the Congress more involved before we start the negotiation rather than afterwards.
I like it, Wayne, and I think it would dovetail well with a suggestion I was sort of cooking up when I worked on the Hill to require that when regulators participate in these international forums, they need to start with a disclaimer that they're not able to make any agreements until they put something out for notice and comment. Mm-hmm. Sort of a disclaimer they'd have to read at the beginning of every meeting. Anyway, Devin, do we have any questions from our audience?
Yeah, thanks, JW, and thanks, Wayne. I don't see any questions queued up at the moment, but we've had a few people join the call since we opened the floor, so I'll just repeat to anyone who might be new or didn't hear my announcement in the beginning that if you have a question, hit star and then the pound button on your telephone keypad, and we'll queue you up to ask your question of either JW or Wayne. But if I could, as a lay lawyer, JW, could I ask a question myself, something that's been on my mind? So recently, Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal and said the following, I quote, "The Fed's been working hard to ensure that its regulation and supervision of banks are tailored appropriately to the size, complexity, and role different institutions play in the financial system," end quote. She went on to say, quote, "For community banks, which by and large avoided the risky business practices that contributed to the financial crisis, we've been focused on making sure that much-needed improvements to regulation and supervision since the crisis are appropriate and not unduly burdensome." Again, I'm a lay person, lay lawyer here. I'm not an expert on these things, but from what I've heard, regulations since, I presume, 2010, have been quite burdensome on community banks. And I wonder whether or not the reports from the Treasury really lead the way in one of those core principles for financial regulation, one of the president's purported core principles for financial regulation that JW mentioned at the beginning of the call, quote, make regulation efficient, effective, and appropriately tailored, kind of lead the way. Are those Treasury reports leading the way in this effort? Because it strikes me as though maybe that the Fed is not been doing that since 2010, if it's the case that not many banks, as I've heard, have been, community banks have been chartered since 2010, and many, in fact, have been shuttered. Sort of a comment there. Are there any reactions to what I've said?
Well, I think that's absolutely essential. I spoke a little bit earlier about the wide variety of banks that we have in the United States. The differences are with regard to size, they're with regard to business model, they're with regard to whether they're federally chartered or state chartered, whether they focus on mortgage lending, they focus on business lending or consumer lending. And we want that wide variety because behind every one of these banks with its particular model, there are a whole bunch of customers who think that's just right for their business or for their family. And we want to preserve that. But when you have regulations that all look the same and treat each bank the same, you end up pushing banks to look the same. You end up homogenizing the approach. And we see this, for example, with regard to home mortgages. The Consumer Bureau was required under the Dodd-Frank Act to develop a variety of different regulations that are intended to make sure that, for example, lenders aren't giving mortgages to somebody who really can't manage the mortgage. Either their income or other characteristics don't put them in a position where they can actually carry the mortgage. So you give them a mortgage, they're likely to be defaulting in that mortgage sooner than later. And that is bad for the institution, and that's bad for the borrower. Well, that's a very good point. You want to make sure that when you make a loan, that the person can pay the loan back. But what the Consumer Bureau did is they came up with a set of criteria that basically decide anybody who fits within these four corners of these criteria, you get to get a mortgage. If you're outside of those corners, you can still lend to those people, but if you do, there's a whole bunch of regulatory penalties that are waiting to hit you if you're not extremely careful. The result has been very few banks will lend outside of those four corners, and there are a lot of people who are very good credit risks who don't meet those criteria because these are one-size-fits-all rules. That's an example of what happens if you don't adjust and tailor the rules for not only the institutions and the risks that the institutions present, but for the businesses that they're trying to present to their customers. The banks are harmed and the customers are harmed. It is hard work to design a rule that has various ways that it applies in order to meet the variety of risks, but you can do it, and you can do it in a way that makes the financial services more flexible, more of a greater variety, and better able to meet the needs of our financial system. So it needs to be done. The regulators are now recognizing that they need to do it. So far, their efforts have been okay to sort of start the process, but really not been enough. Most of their efforts are focused on, depending on how big your bank is. Well, the size of your bank really doesn't tell you a whole lot about the risks involved with that bank. Banks of all sizes fail. For a whole variety of different reasons. What you need to do is look at the business model and make sure that the rules are addressed to the type of business you're engaged in.
And I would add to Wayne's point that some of the work done by my colleagues at the Mercatus Center, Hester Peirce and Patrick McLaughlin and Steph Miller, surveying community banks, have done some extensive surveys of community banks, randomized surveys and a fairly large number of respondents. We've got a number of statistically significant results that show that regulatory costs has led to a reduction in lending, led to even for banks exempt from rules, they have to spend a great deal to determine that they are in fact exempt from rules. And many of them report they're hiring more compliance personnel than loan officers, which is a pretty strong sign of an economy going wrong. Devin, anyone new jumping in to ask a question?
No, not at the moment. I think that we've got some folks who are intimidated on the line with the two of you, but I have another question that perhaps people on the line might be interested in knowing the answer to or your perspectives on it. May I ask another?
Yes, go ahead, man.
Yeah, my question really is sort of a crystal ball, like, you know, can you prognosticate on what we can expect with upcoming reports? What are the reports about? What can we expect? And any reaction to those that are upcoming, November and December reports?
Yeah, thanks for raising that, Devin, because that is important. We didn't mention that just last week the Treasury came forward with their second report. We've been talking really about the June report and digging deeply into that because that most directly affects banks, and particularly as banks affect their customers. But the report that came out just last week deals with capital markets, and it's designed to try to make the capital markets work better, more liquidity to the markets, removing a lot of the rules that just gum up the ability of the financial markets to move smoothly and to invite more participants into the financial markets. So that's the one that came out last week. We think the next ones, we think there may be at least two, maybe three. One seems to be focused on the insurance industry. That should be coming out in the next several weeks between now and December. And then there's another one that they talk about, and I think this is one that the Treasury has been developing as they've gone through this exercise, but they say it will be a report that speaks to the future. That is, it looks at the future developments of the industry. I think that's the one that's going to look at fintech in particular and maybe look at other evolutions in the financial system. Maybe it's going to look more at asset management and wealth creation, which are very important things with regard to the future of our economy, making sure that the United States continues to be the leader in providing financial services not only to our customers but, frankly, globally. So those are a couple more yet to come. If they are like the first two, they will certainly be well worth reading, not just by us, but most importantly by policymakers.
Yeah, I think this is a terrific... I'm sorry?
No, JW, please.
Yeah, I think this is a terrific series of reports. I was really excited about a number of issues contained in the recent capital market report last week, and a number of issues I've been, you know, writing about and working on and listening to people in the venture capital community talk about. Some of the things they worry about the most in trying to bring companies public is things like the shareholder proposal process and proxy advisors and some abuses of the system that have led to sort of a politicization of corporate governance. Treasury's doing a great job there. And this harkens back to something that I think the Bush administration and the Paulson Treasury Department doesn't get nearly enough credit for. Was the Paulson Blueprint on Financial Regulation. They did a lot of hard and deep thinking under Assistant Secretary Nason, who I believe succeeded Wayne at Treasury in that role. And they did a lot of tough thinking about the future of financial regulation well before the crisis. And unfortunately, the Democrats who led this effort in the Congress just completely ignored that report. But I think you can I credit Republicans for doing some deep thinking on financial regulation, both before the crisis and now after the post-crisis era is sort of coming to an end. We're continuing to work on that to look to growth. So I think it'll be an exciting series of reports.
Certainly worthwhile looking at, that's for sure.
Yeah. Wayne, we haven't talked yet much about the CFPB. Since we have a little time, I want to ask you about some of the recommendations contained in the Treasury report of June with respect to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau created by Dodd-Frank. It's been a very controversial agency, certainly a very powerful agency in its regulation, some say micromanagement of consumer credit. There are references to reforming the organization of the CFPB. And these are, I think, probably informed by some of Chairman Hinsling's work and the various iterations of the Choice Act. And I'm proud to say they cite very heavily my colleague, Professor Todd Zawicki at Scalia Law, and his work on these issues. There are a few ideas out there referenced in the report. One is to create a board, a bipartisan board, to run the CFPB. Another idea is to keep the director of the CFPB instead of a board, but make him an at-will employee, removable for cause, and also limiting some of the powers of the CFPB. In advance of the CFPB's creation, some others suggested just giving powers over to the FTC. And, of course, one of the concerns all along was, well, because of the unique nature of banks, bank regulators should retain consumer protection so they can balance any regulatory costs against the safety and soundness of the institutions they regulate. Wayne, which of these approaches do you think is best? And which one is sort of second best, I guess, assuming the CFPB retains its status as an agency?
Well, yeah, if you assume the Bureau is going to be around, then one of the options that you mentioned is not an option, and that is going back to the way it was before the Bureau was created. In other words, making sure that every financial regulator, as part of its responsibility, has to look at the impact on consumers. That responsibility has been taken away from the Federal Reserve, from the FDIC, from the Comptroller of the Currency, and placed in this one particular agency. That decision has been made, and if we're assuming that's where that's going to stay, then the question needs to be is, okay, we've got a new agency, but what seems to be the biggest problem with that agency is it lacks accountability. And that is inimical to our American system of government. If you have a government that's based upon meeting the needs of the people who own the government, the people who are on whose authority the government is created, it needs to be accountable to those people. The Bureau is seriously, seriously lacking in accountability. And one of those serious things is the fact that there's one person who makes a decision. In the Consumer Bureau, every conversation in the end ends with, yes, sir. There is nobody in that organization who is a peer of the one-man director. When the one-man director decides, that's it. There is no more discussion. It's done. And why that's a problem, besides accountability, and that's a very important thing, we've seen some abuses with that. There's a very important court case that's working its way through the courts called the PHH case, where the director looked at a decision made by a lower-level person in the Bureau, where a certain penalty was assigned to a company, and he increased that penalty by an order of magnitude, I think, 12 times what the original penalty was. And the that authority, that hubris, that lack of accountability is now working its way through the courts. But the other problem besides that just abuse of power is when you have one person in charge of anything, you only have one set of eyes looking at it. And if that person's going to focus on anything, by definition, focus means I'm not looking at other stuff. We've created a number of government agencies that have boards. And the boards, what they allow is that there are several people, a commission, a board, or whatever, who are equals of the chairman. And they can look that chairman in the eye and say, you forgot something. Or what do you think about this? Or I think you're forgetting about this, or you're not taking something else into account. And that, I think, results in a better product. An example of how we can see that that's not working at the Bureau, when they consider a rule, they put out a proposed rule for comment, as I talked about earlier, and then they take in that comment, and they almost never make much in the way of adjustments to their proposal. They then finalize the rule that looks an awful lot to what they proposed, and now the comments that they receive from the public that said this, this, or that isn't going to work right, they assume, no, I wouldn't have put that out if I thought that was a problem. They finalize the rule, and then they discover that those comments were right, that a number of the things that they proposed just aren't going to work very well. And then they make their changes after they have finalized the rule, which is a very backward and painful way on the economy and on the people to have to deal with regulations. And those are just two of the problems that you have when you have just one person in place. So a commission is certainly better. If you can't get to the commission, or maybe as a step of getting to the commission, you at least allow the president to fire anybody who works for him. And if the head of the Bureau is not part of the executive branch of government, which is headed by the president of the United States, which branch of government does it belong to? Is it the court system? Is it the Congress? Well, we know it's neither of those. So if it's part of the executive branch, then the head of the executive branch should be able to fire anybody who is in the executive branch, because ultimately he or she who's sitting in that office that has no corners in it, in the Oval Office in the White House, that person is responsible and should be able to decide in the end, I don't like the way that person's carrying out his or her job. I want somebody else there to do it.
Very good.
Well,
point.
I have to say, the great key theme today seems to be accountability. So a great Treasury report, great discussion with Wayne. I'm always privileged to be here with you, my friend, and talk about financial regulation. It was a highlight of the week. So thank
Plenty
you all for letting
about.
Me do this.
Yeah,
Devin, do you want
to? Thank you.
We actually have one question pending. Would you like to take it?
Yeah, sure. I'd If Wayne has time.
Go ahead.
All right, yes, Wayne,
okay,
we got to go off. Yeah.
We've got about a minute, and if you have any final thoughts after the question, we'll take those too. So, caller, after you hear the prompt, go ahead and ask your question, and we'll try to answer within a minute.
Well, hi, this is Joe Mont over at Compliance Week. And, you know, we're looking at the two Treasury reports and just voluminous numbers of suggestions, ideas, and actions. You pair that with the Financial Choice Act, which is out there, and even if you look at the House Financial Services Committee yesterday, a whole slew of other legislative proposals came out, and more will come. Are there any concerns that it's too much too quickly? You look at the Dodd-Frank Act, which had you know, this laundry list of ideas, many of them a little bit on a different ideological plane, but you know, you ended up having some painful ambiguities and unintended consequences. So I was wondering what you thought, you know, is there such a thing as maybe trying to do too much at once, and would there be a prioritization approach that maybe you would recommend?
Well, I think that's what's going to happen on setting priorities. The Dodd-Frank Act mandated close to 400 new regulations, and for the, 7 years that the Dodd-Frank Act has been in place, they haven't even finished writing the 400 rules that were set in the act that they should do. So you're correct. When you put too much on the table, it's hard to eat it all. So I think what's going to happen is the regulators will look at these various proposals, recommendations, and they'll start asking, what are the things that we can do now? What's doable now? What needs to be done now? And then we'll go through to others as time goes by. I think it's going to be an iterative process. So they'll do some things now, see how that works, then go and do some others. What you don't want to do is create turbulence in our financial system, but what you want to do is ask which are the things that are really holding back economic growth, and where the rules that have been put in place, as good as they may be in terms of what they want to achieve, might be overdoing it with this or that provision, imposing more cost than is necessary or more rigmarole that you have to go through in order to actually get to the spot where you need to be. Dealing with those things as you go forward, I think that's going to be a process that takes place over a number of years, but it's probably a good idea to get as much of these things out on the table as possible so you can start asking, which ones should we do first? And then some of these others we can look at as time goes by.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks, Wayne, for your answer. I hope that answers your question, Joe. Wayne, JW, any final thoughts?
I certainly want to
thank you,
the Federalist Society for doing this and JW for your wonderful questions. I'll leave you the last point. I'll just mention this point. There is a different mood in the country with regard to the need to get the economy going. And some of the drag that has been on the economy has been regulations that aren't working as well as they should. These reports are a call for fixing those regulations, not getting rid of all of them, but fixing things to make sure they work better. That's something I think we all have an interest in. JW?
Sure, Wayne. This is a real treat to work with Federal Society and to have a chance to sit down and talk to Wayne, who's been thinking about financial regulation for a long time. There's a wealth of thought out there from American bankers, from us at Mercatus, up on the House and Senate committees, and I think there's a great group of new people coming in to run things, from Vice Chairman Quarles to the names that have been floated for FDIC and the new Comptroller of the Currency. I think it's an exciting time to see in financial regulatory reform, and I can't wait to see it happen.
Okay, thanks so much, fellows. And on behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank our audience for joining us. I hope that everyone will be able to join us again for our next installment of Free Lunch. But until then, so long, everyone. Goodbye.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's REGproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.